calling 911 when in an accident may just not be enough. Car accident, remember. After 911, call 411. 1-800-411-PAIN. 1-800-411-PAIN is a legal and medical referral service. Non-employee spokesperson.
Underway, your chance to win $1,000 just by listening to The Ticket. From now until August 11th, it's the training camp $1,000 4-a-days. You can win $1,000 four times a day. Listen to The Ticket at 7 and 8 a.m., 4 and 5 p.m., Monday to Friday. Get the code word, text it to 72881. That's 72881, and you just might win $1,000. The training camp $1,000 4-a-days on AM 790 and FM 104.3. HD2, The Ticket. Welcome back here to 790 The Ticket. Greg Likens alongside Barry Jackson filling in for Josh Friedman. Friedo will be back tomorrow night, normal time, 7 to 10. I'll be joining him as we'll be talking about whatever transpires tomorrow in training camp. And also, we're expecting to have Antoine Walker join the show at 7:15 tomorrow night. Looking forward to that conversation. Before we went to break, Barry, we were talking about the top 400 players list that the MMQB came out with, and if you weren't listening, 12 Dolphins players were ranked on this. The last of the 12, who comes in at number 347 overall, was quarterback Ryan Tannehill. Tannehill was the 22nd of 23 quarterbacks ranked on this particular list. Alex Smith was ranked one behind him. Barry, I know you know you've written before, you referenced it already, about Tannehill's personal quarterback coach saying that he expects that he has the potential to be a top 10 quarterback. This has always been, I think, for the fans especially, a big talking point, is where Tannehill resides among the good QBs or great QBs in the National Football League. What is your reaction when you hear that he's ranked 22nd out of the 23 on this particular list?
I think it's too low. And I also think it's a joke that he's 347 and Jordan Phillips is 241. How do you possibly justify that based on career body of work? The problem with this list is it doesn't specify whether it's based off last season. Because if you base it off last season, Ryan Tannehill was a top 15 quarterback in the league before his injury. He was 12th in passer rating, and I know passer rating isn't the end-all and the be-all. It can be overstated. But his work last year during that winning streak, with the exception of the Baltimore game, was terrific, right? I mean, he finished the year with a passer rating that was a career high of 93.5. 19 touchdowns, 12 picks. And so to me, you could easily make the case now that he is top 20. You even could make the case, I think, that he's top 15. But I think where he is on this list, 22, is too low. Obviously, the coach that we mentioned, Jeff Christensen, the personal coach for Tannehill, is going to be biased. I asked someone who's not biased his opinion of where he would rank Tannehill, Mark Dominic, the former Tampa Bay general manager who's done work for ESPN. He said he could make a case for top 16, but he said without question top 20. Okay. So I think at this point to put him outside the top 20 is selling him short. And if you are basing it off last year, how can you rank him behind Andy Dalton, who had been the better quarterback before last year, but certainly not the case last year? How can you rank him behind Joe Flacco if you're basing it on last year? Now, career-wise, obviously Flacco should be ahead of Tannehill. Mm-hmm. But based on last year, Tannehill was clearly the better quarterback. And he was also clearly better than Sam Bradford, who had a high throwing 1-yard passes, right? So to me, Tannehill should be somewhere between 15 and 20. Tell you else what stands out for me on this list. I think it's ridiculous that Jarvis Landry is as low as he is at 178, that Rashad Jones is as low as 142, and that Cam Wake is as low as 134. Now, this is not me being in love with the Dolphins' talent, because I think their talent is middle of the pack in the league. But I think those players deserve higher rankings than what they got. What sticks out to you on this list?
Yeah, the Jarvis Landry one, he's ranked 21st out of the wide receivers. And that seems terribly low. Now, again, sometimes I'm guilty of it. We're very close to the Dolphins. And so we tend to be very Dolphin-centric just because we're living here and this is the team. But if you even take a big picture look at the league, how Jarvis Landry, and I know that we're all caught up in his contract discussions, or lack thereof, I guess, basically, right?
Right.
But, you know, the potential for a new contract and how much he's going to make, it's hard for me to believe that when you look at this particular list, he ranks below the likes. I'm going to tell you the receivers that are ranked just ahead of him. Doug Baldwin, Brandon Marshall, DeAndre Hopkins, Tyreek Hill, Martavis Bryant, who hasn't played. He didn't play last season because he was suspended for drugs the entire year. Amari Cooper, Brandon Cooks, DeSean Jackson, Julian Edelman, T.Y. Hilton. And so, you know, you brought up T.Y. Hilton before. You know, I don't know. Like, if this is based on watching film primarily, like, Jarvis Landry, to me, jumps out on the film. But, again, I don't watch film professionally. So 21st just seems awfully low for a guy that, as you pointed out earlier, he and his fellow LSU Tiger, Odell Beckham Jr., set an NFL record with 288 receptions in their first three seasons. For him to be just the 21st ranked receiver, that doesn't seem fair, in my opinion.
And the Dolphins players did much better, by the way, in the annual NFL.com vote of their peers, of players' peers.
Yes.
Cameron Wake was top 70. Sue, I think, was higher on that list than he is on this list at 51, or at least very comparable to it. On that list, Jarvis Landry was what, top 7? Remember, he was 98, and then he rose. Where did he end up? In the 40s?
He's in the 40s, NFL? I
yes,
believe.
Exactly.
Right. By his
yes,
peers.
So it's right, by his peers, which I would take a lot more seriously than this one done by a writer. No disrespect to the writer. But Landry at 178 seems way too low. But I think there's still doubts about Tannehill, and this speaks to those doubts, right?
It does speak to those doubts. And so I open that up to our audience here. Just in general, what do you think of Ryan Tannehill, the prospects for him entering this season? Because, again, I'm not saying that you have to be in love with Ryan Tannehill as a quarterback, but I agree with you. Like, 22 of all the quarterbacks, he being ranked the 22nd, does not seem fair. So if you want to text us, 67974, you can do so. You can also call the show at 786-360-0790. We'll talk more about that in a moment, but right now, let's get to headlines.
Here's what's trending now in Miami on The Ticket. WAXYAM South Miami and FM 104.3 HD2 Miramar.
The radio home of the Miami Heat.
The Miami Dolphins kicked off their 2017 training camp this morning in Davie with practice number one of the new season. And they're largely healthy as Mike Pouncey and Rashad Jones both worked on the side with trainers, but mainly as a precaution. Meanwhile, Anthony Fasano was excused from practice for personal reasons. Quarterback Ryan Tannehill said that his left knee feels really good and that there haven't been any changes since he returned to action this spring. In other news, owner Stephen Ross addressed a number of topics with the media today, including Jarvis Landry, saying he's unsure whether the wide receiver will be signed to a new contract before the season begins. Elsewhere in the NFL, Steelers running back Le'Veon Bell did not report to Pittsburgh's training camp today after failing to reach an agreement on a long-term deal this offseason. He has yet to sign his $12.12 million franchise tender. To baseball, where a day after scoring a franchise record 22 runs in a win over the Rangers, the Marlins have returned home tonight and have opened up a weekend series against the Cincinnati Reds. And right now, it's not going to be anywhere close to 22, at least at this rate, but they are ahead of the Reds 2-0 in the bottom of the fifth inning. And Derek Dietrich hit a solo home run to get them one of the runs. And then the other run came courtesy of a Derek Dietrich walk with the bases loaded. Giancarlo Stanton scored, so that gets you two runs for the Marlins, with Dietrich accounting for both of those RBIs. We'll continue to update you on the score of that game until 10 o'clock when we're off the air, but those are your headlines. Barry, I'm reading some of these text messages here regarding Ryan Tannehill. One of them says that Tannehill is the only thing holding this offense back from being top tier. Not saying it will be good or bad, but imagine the rest of the offense with an Aaron Rodgers. LOL.
but what? You're talking about the top five quarterbacks in the league. Of course, everybody would be better if you had Brady or Aaron. I mean, who even else would you include in that group at this point beyond Brady and Rodgers and Breeze, right? I get maybe Prescott, but 1 year is an awfully small body of work put him in that group yet.
Maybe a Big Ben.
Right, sure.
In terms of accomplishments, but Matt Ryan, I guess, because he was the MVP
absolutely
last year.
Right. But with Cam Newton, it's been one great year and then a significant regression.
Right.
Yeah, Ryan definitely should be on that list. So that's five right there.
Yeah, and as this loads here for me, Bear, I'm looking at, as we were referencing this list, the MMQB list, they've got here, Brady is he's number one overall as far as the top 400. Aaron Rodgers they have is sixth overall. Ben Roethlisberger 16th. Matt Ryan 28th. Andrew Luck comes in as the next highest ranked quarterback, even though he's entering this season with injury problems. And then Drew Brees, Philip Rivers, Eli Manning, Matthew Stafford, Derek Carr. Those are their top quarterbacks, according to the list. Just real quickly, getting back to Tannehill, though, I know you brought up a couple of names that you would argue Tannehill could rank above, especially based on last season. I'm not saying that a couple of these guys don't have terrific potential, but how would Jameis Winston be ranked ahead of Ryan Tannehill at this point?
Right. I mean, could see Mariota,
right,
possibly because
nice
of what
numbers
he showed last year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But Winston, to me, that would be a bit of a reach yet, even if you project him to be better than Tannehill long term, which would be a reasonable projection.
Right. If somebody came to me and said, this is a list of the quarterbacks, you know, we think will be the best in over the next couple of years, and Jameis Winston's ranked ahead, I'm fine with that. But, you know, based on last year, and again, I know that this list, we already told you what the baseline is in terms of what they were looking at. And a lot of this is just, does player A do his job better or worse than player B, according to the MMQB? But Ryan Tannehill, I think, largely deserves the credit for the team going to the playoffs in terms from the quarterback position. And I think that means something. That's why Alex Smith being ranked below Tannehill, having been a consistent playoff quarterback, whether you think he's a great quarterback or not, I don't understand how you rank some of these other players who haven't even sniffed the playoffs and may have some nice talent, but it's like, if they're not leading their teams, I mean, what's the quarterback position based around primarily? Gets back to the same question that Ryan Tannehill sort of posed to the media today when he's talking about his goals. Like, his goal is to win games and get them to the playoffs and accomplish team goals. It's not about putting up individual numbers.
Right. And imagine if every player in the league was made a free agent for a draft. Obviously, Ryan Tannehill's going a lot higher than 347.
Right.
Now, that speaks, of course, largely to the need for a quarterback. But at the same time, if you just had a quarterback draft, because of his age, obviously, you know, still being in the prime of his career, wouldn't you think he'd go top 16? Top 70, maybe even higher.
Right. Because such a premium at that position.
Right. Right. And there are guys that you might have made the case who could have gone higher before the last year, who now you say wouldn't go higher. I wouldn't draft Andy Dalton higher than Tannehill based on last year.
No.
Certainly Teddy Bridgewater, who some a year and a half ago might have taken ahead of Tannehill. You can't now because of the serious knee injury. He's
right.
Going to begin the year, it appears, on PUP in Minnesota.
And
so there are a bunch of guys who have fallen off the map, or at least have fallen considerably in rankings, that Ryan seems to have surpassed them.
Right, and the point you made, you bring up Bridgewater, his replacement there in Sam Bradford. I mean, I don't think you can talk to anybody. I'm stunned to see his name above the likes of Kirk Cousins, Marcus Mariota, Dalton, and Tannehill and Smith. Like, I don't know. Anyway, that just doesn't seem to be attached to any logic whatsoever. Real quickly, just looking at the division, this won't surprise anybody, but I mentioned that the Dolphins had 12 players on this list. The team with the most players on the list was the Patriots. They had 20 players appear on this list. The team with the least, the New York Jets.
What a shock.
5 players in the top 400, according to
this
list.
And who are those? Bilal Powell and who else?
A couple of the defensive linemen in Richardson and Wilkerson.
Right.
But
yeah, exactly.
After that, and then the Bills, just so everybody is aware, within the division, 11 players on this list.
Oh, my gosh. And to think the Patriots have gotten even stronger,
right?
I was ready for Steve Ross to ask today, hey, why didn't New Orleans get more for Brandon Cooks, right? to add Cooks and to add Stephen Gilmore. And obviously, they lost Martellus Bennett, but to be able to sign Dwayne Allen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've made a team that was nearly unbeatable even better. And that, of course, is the conundrum that the Dolphins and the rest of the AFC East face every year. How do you possibly beat a team that seems insurmountable? Which would mean you're basically going to be battling likely for a wild card berth, you know, with Pittsburgh or Baltimore, Cincinnati, whoever loses that division,
mm-hmm.
whoever loses among Tennessee, Houston, and Indy. And then probably Denver, Kansas City, or Oakland loser. So, you know, the problem is you're going to be again battling about 7 or 8 teams for 2 wild card berths, and the odds would be against that. But you do know that you did it last year, so that gives you a feeling that you could possibly do it again, albeit with a more difficult schedule. I will say this. you need to start strong. And I don't say that in a cliche sort of way. You need to start strong this year because the back half of the schedule is very, very difficult.
Right.
You need to emerge with three or four wins from that opening stretch of obviously home to Tampa Bay to start, then at the Chargers in Los Angeles, then at the Jets, which they absolutely have to win, then London to play New Orleans, and then Tennessee at home. Irene, don't you need to win at least three and probably four of those games, knowing how difficult the rest of the schedule is?
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, if you can go 4-1 realistically in that stretch, because again, I don't think anytime you look at the schedule and just say, oh yeah, that's a win, that's a loss. I mean, that's a little too simplistic. We all know with the parity in the league that week to week, you just never know. So 4-1, I think is reasonable. If they can do that, I think, yes, that's highly necessary if they are going to even sniff, you know, what a lot of the local expectations are based on the 10 wins a year ago.
Right. And they have very difficult games out of conference and out of division. Once again, Baltimore again, having to go to Carolina on a Monday night. Oakland, which will be the Dolphins' first NBC Sunday night game in many years, right, unless it's flexed out. So the schedule in November and December, not to even mention at New England Thanksgiving weekend, it's just going to be very grueling. So, yeah, I think at bare minimum 3-2, and even that would be a disappointing start. I would think 4-1 would be needed to be a legitimate playoff contender in December.
I agree. And, hey, if you can go 5-0, I mean, you know, don't
why
worry
not?
About it. Yeah, do it. Look, quickly before we take a timeout, we've been talking about Ryan Tannehill. Let's go out to Miami Beach and the phone lines where Gordon is standing by. Gordon, thanks for joining the show. What's going on tonight? All right. Guess Gordon's not there. Give us a call back, Gordon. Funny how that works sometimes. Barry, I want to touch on a number of other things. We've got some more phone calls, and we've been talking a lot of Dolphins. The real hot topic over the last couple of weeks has been Kyrie Irving and that possibility. So I do want to touch on the NBA with you because you had a report over the last couple of days about whether that would be realistic or not for the Dolphins the Heat to potentially pick him up and be available. So when we come back, we'll do that. Plus, there's some doubt about who owns the New York Jets. Who is the owner? Stephen Ross spoke today for the Dolphins. We know Woody Johnson owns the Jets, but there's some doubt about that. I'll explain that next here on 790 The Ticket.
Another turning point, a fork stuck in the road. Time grabs you by the wrist, directs you where to go.
Backed it up here and every Friday with Romberg on the morning show, sponsored by Botron Rum, the taste of perfection, award-winning Botron Rum, rum that is not just aged, but nurtured. Welcome back here to 790 The Ticket. Greg Likens alongside Barry Jackson filling in for Josh Friedman on this Thursday night. Hope everybody is having a great evening, and I'm sure lots of excitement from the Dolphins fans, not just here in South Florida, but all over the world, as the season is finally upon us. 2017 officially began today with the first practice. We've been talking about all the different angles and elements of that as the show has gone on. I do want to talk some NBA in just a few minutes, but I mentioned before the break, there's some question about who owns the New York Jets. Now, this wasn't some trick question that I put out there. I mean, we all know, and nothing's changed, Woody Johnson does actually own the New York Jets. But I guess there's a glitch in the internet, Barry, because this is interesting. This was kind of trending today on social media, and I tested it out. I did it myself. When you Google search New York Jets owner, a picture of Tom Brady comes up.
Oh, my gosh. So who's responsible for this?
We're not sure who's responsible, but then I looked up Jets owner of the New York Jets, in different, you know, phrasing it a little differently, and each time a picture of Tom Brady comes up as Tom Brady, owner, New York Jets.
Wow. Was this the same guy who stole Brady's thing after the Super Bowl?
The jersey?
The jersey, right.
I don't know, but he does have a 23-7 career record against the Jets.
So he owns the Jets.
So he owns the New York Jets.
Ah.
I think that's what everybody was getting at. Of course, all of the outlets in Boston had a field day with this up in the Northeast. But yeah, this was something that was trending today. I haven't tested it tonight. Maybe, Santi, you can test this out, do a quick Google search. If it's still the case, no, they fixed it? Okay. But for a few hours this afternoon, if you looked up who the New York Jets owner was, it would tell you that Tom Brady owned the team.
Wow. Now, have they linked Russia to this cracking of the...
I'm not sure how deep this goes.
Yes, yeah, I expect a Senate committee investigate this.
I'm not sure if this is like Sully in his basement in New England
right.
who decided to pull this off, or if it goes a little deeper than that.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's funny. But so Woody Johnson, now an ambassador, right?
Yes, yes.
But yet Jeffrey Loria, not an ambassador. We thought that he'd be ambassador to France, but for whatever reason, that fell apart. I asked somebody about that, and they had no explanation.
Really?
For why Trump was considering Loria and then apparently no longer considering Loria.
Yeah, it just didn't
so
happen.
Loria can't be an ambassador and he can't sell his team.
Can't do much of anything right these
No,
days.
Yeah. No, or get close to 500 either.
Right, right. Barry, we're going to talk some NBA in a moment, but I do want to, Gordon called us back. So let's go back to Miami Beach. Gordon, you there this time?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Gordon. Thanks for joining the show. What's going on?
Well, I always think he's untainted. I mean, I was one of those guys who didn't think he could play. I think last year I changed my whole opinion of him, and I mean, it had a lot to do with the fact that Jay Ajayi was emerged. He's got all the tools around him this year. I mean, if anyone saw the Pittsburgh playoff game, we had no defense. I mean, they toasted us. I mean, it was that game was over in the first quarter. That was the real problem, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't so much the offense. I mean, granted, we had a backup quarterback, but. And we probably would have had a better chance with Tannehill, but I don't think Tannehill's the problem. If he stinks this year because he's got all the tools around him, then he's going to have to go, right?
I do agree that this is, in a way, a make or break year for Tannehill in terms of his contract scenario. Like, if he's really bad, they might have to move on from him. I don't anticipate him being really bad if he can stay healthy, but I agree with you, Gordon, that there are more lingering, burning questions on the defensive
right.
side of the ball than on offense.
And then real quickly on the NBA,
yeah.
I know you're transitioning to that. I mean, I'm following, but I'm not following so much this Kyrie Irving thing. I mean, I was thinking about it. You know, about Dan Gilbert made this comment about how, you know, they should have the trade that we proposed proposed to Indiana for Paul George was a better deal. I mean, maybe it's just this. Maybe they just wanted them out. Maybe Indiana just said, listen, I want them out of the Eastern Conference. And we don't want to see him, and we'll move him out to the West Coast, and we'll move him to the Western Conference. Do you think it's going to be the same thing where, you know, if they trade Kyrie Irving, they're going to trade him to a Western Conference team because they don't want to face him three or four times a year? And if I'm the Heat, if we don't get him, I hope he goes to Minnesota because it's just going to make them even worse.
Yeah, that's a possibility, Gordon. Thanks for the phone call. Appreciate you chiming in tonight. We'll get to the Heat perspective on that in a second. If I'm Kyrie Irving, I'd like to stay in the East, considering the competitive balance that's there, but he does not have a say because he doesn't have a no-trade clause. So certainly Cleveland can wait around for whatever the best offer is, assuming they do make the deal. As it relates to the Heat, though, Barry, you had the report this week. I'll let you take the floor on this, but in terms of their interests and the possibility of this happening, what did you learn?
Well, the Heat certainly has explored this, but at this point, they have no level of optimism at all about being able to complete a deal. They believe that their assets are simply not good enough in Cleveland's estimation. So the sense I got from the Heat is that they don't expect something to happen. They would be surprised if something did happen. At the same time, nobody's able to rule it out because it's possible if everything else that Cleveland has working falls through, possibly they could circle back to Miami for a package that would include Goran Dragic and probably Justice Winslow and perhaps Josh Richardson as well. So, but at this point, other teams can simply make more appealing offers. Remember, Phoenix and Minnesota have two quality young players at wing positions, the type of players the Heat simply does not have to offer. Phoenix has Eric Bledsoe, who's still in his mid to late 20s. Andrew Wiggins from Minnesota is only 22. The Heat has no one like that they can offer. Dragic, obviously you're talking about a 30-year-old. Justice Winslow doesn't have much value at this point. He has to rebuild his value, and he has to show that he can shoot. And as Zach Lowe from ESPN mentioned, the last thing LeBron wants is a wing player who can't shoot. And that's at this point what Justice Winslow is until he proves otherwise. Heck, you could come up with a list of a dozen teams that could offer something more attractive. Boston certainly could, with Isaiah Thomas and Jay Crowder and some of their stable of draft picks. Charlotte could if they were to offer Kemba Walker. The Pelicans could if they were to offer DeMarcus Cousins to have an Anthony Davis pairing with Kyrie Irving. The Knicks, if they did relent and offer Porzingis, who to this point, from all indications, they haven't offered, that would certainly be a more appealing offer if they were to offer Porzingis and Carmelo for a package of Kyrie and, say, Tristan Thompson. So I would say the Heat's offer would be probably, bottom half of the league in terms of quality in Cleveland's eyes. Of course, Gilbert said yesterday he expects Kyrie to be on the roster for the opening of training camp, which might have been, disingenuous. But I don't think that can be ruled out, because I could easily see Tyronn Lue trying to get LeBron and Kyrie in a room together and just trying to have them work it out and say, let's go at this for at least one more year, see if everything works, see if LeBron is willing to make some compromises. The thing that's so confusing about this is Kyrie averaged more shots last year than LeBron.
Right.
So what exactly does Kyrie want? He simply wants his name to be atop the list of stars on a team, right? I mean, to me, this is so purely ego-driven, because shots are not an issue. He's taking more shots per game than LeBron is.
And LeBron, I don't know what happens behind the scenes, but outwardly, he has spoken so highly of Kyrie Irving and talked about the need that they want him to be the go-to guy and all this other stuff. So, again, I know that LeBron James can be, very calculated in all the moves he makes. And outwardly, his public persona is very important. And he always does things that I think on purpose in terms of how he protects his image and his brand. So it might be a completely different story behind the scenes. But I'm with you. It's very odd that this would come up. At the same time, as difficult as for us to fathom, for me to fathom, because they're having such success, and it's almost a guarantee they'll be in the NBA Finals again if they come back the same way they have the last few years, is that if you're Irving and you signed up to be the guy in the franchise player, and then a month or two later, LeBron then decides he's going to return to Cleveland. Because, he signed that deal before LeBron decided to come back, then in a way, I can sort of understand that this wasn't what he signed up for, and that he thought he was going to be the guy to try to elevate the franchise, and then LeBron just said, hey, I'm coming back home, and the whole deal, I'm going to, write this letter with Lee Jenkins on SI's website and announce to the world. But I'm with you, Barry. This has a ton to do with ego, and I think we all know in following these sports, especially the NBA, where there's only five guys on the court, if you want to be great, you got to have a certain amount of ego. Pat Riley's got an ego. Dan Gilbert's got an ego. All of these people who are involved in these situations have egos to certain degrees. And I don't know if at certain times it gets the better of them. And if that's the case with Kyrie Irving.
I know people got excited when they read that Kyrie was on the list of four teams that he preferred to go to. But that means nothing.
I'm guilty, Barry. I got excited.
Right. But that means nothing, because you think Cleveland has any inclination to send him to a place that he wants to be and not get assets that might be better from a team that he doesn't want to be? And even if Kyrie threatens that he wouldn't re-sign, heck, 2 years is a long time in the NBA, and the team that acquires him could easily trade him in a year and a half before the trade deadline for assets at that point. I think the team best equipped to do something would be Phoenix. They could offer Eric Bledsoe and a draft pick. Josh Jackson is a player that probably would come up in discussions, Phoenix high draft pick. And then I think with the Wolves, it could be as simple as Andrew Wiggins and then maybe Jeff Teague. But remember, the factor with Teague is you can't trade players who you signed as free agents until December 15th. So perhaps this deal would have to wait until mid-December, which would certainly create some awkwardness in Cleveland. But if that's the best deal that Cleveland's offered, then perhaps you just wait this out till mid-December. A couple other quick NBA things from today, by the way. I've been impressed by what Orlando has done in the last week, getting really good value signings with Jonathan Simmons from the Spurs, mm-hmm. Aaron Aflalo, who took a minimum deal. He was one of the best players left in free agency, and Maurice Spates, who's a big who can shoot threes. So quietly, they've improved their depth. Maybe they could be a team competing for the eighth spot. Golden State today added or signed JaVale McGee, so they continue to complete their roster. So not a lot left in free agency. There doesn't appear to be anyone that's worth the Heat's $4.3 million exception. I had asked the Heat about Derrick Rose. I know they liked him as a player, but it never reached the point of them offering him their $4.3 million exception, because the question was, where would the minutes come from? They have five guards who they want to play. Goran obviously is entrenched as the starter. The one interesting thing about Rose, Greg, that I thought was that took me aback a little bit during the press conference for the Cavaliers yesterday, was Kobe Altman saying that Derrick Rose is going to be the backup here and saying that he's prepared for that mentally. Why would he say that with the specter of a possible Irving trade? Does that mean that he assumes he's going to get a point guard back in the Irving trade? Because to me, if I'm Cleveland, what I do is if I trade Kyrie Irving, I want the best player back, period. It doesn't have to be a point guard. If Andrew Wiggins is the best player offered to me plus something else, then that's what I would do. And Derrick Rose could easily be a stopgap point guard for a year. So I found it odd that he said sort of unequivocally, Derrick Rose is going to be a backup here.
Yeah, that is odd. And in the parts of that press conference that I watched, it felt like, you know, Kobe Altman, I thought, came across well. He's, you know, he was an impressive guy. Dan Gilbert, you know, he is who he is. I think, you know, he's lived up to his reputation to a certain degree. But it felt both of them, though, at times were trying to force the narrative or message that they, you know, I think had set themselves upon. You know, they went, you know, with their PR crew, or maybe just the two of them, they decided, hey, this is what we want to accomplish in this press conference. So maybe he was just kind of overdoing it with Derrick Rose and like trying to leave the door open that Kyrie would stick around. And so then, yeah, Derrick would be comfortable with that. But that is odd that he would say that so definitively in that setting, because it's not really his call, right? Shouldn't it be up to Ty Lue to determine, you know,
who's the starter? Yeah. Right. That decision would always be left to a coach. Now, as far as other teams that could make a bid, San Antonio, if they were to offer Aldridge and Tony Parker, you know, we talked about Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Sacramento might be able to cobble together some draft picks, although I don't know that they could offer anything appealing. Denver would be an interesting team because they have some young pieces, some quality young players that they could offer. So there are probably about a dozen viable options. But from all indications, Cleveland wants the motherlode. I mean, they just want a ton. And another disadvantage that the Heat has, besides lacking a skilled young wing player who can shoot, is the fact that they are the only team in the league that cannot trade a first-round draft pick before 2023. So Cleveland, from all indications, wants two quality starters, including one high-level player and a draft pick. And the Heat simply cannot offer a first rounder until 2023. And who knows who's running the Cavs then?
Right, exactly. Based on the track record of Dan Gilbert, it'll be a different general manager.
Right.
The ironic part about a potential Minnesota deal, which, you know, you're aware of, is that if they get back Andrew Wiggins, it's like, you know, they drafted him number one overall initially. So that would be odd. And then if the Phoenix deal does come to fruition, it is Eric Bledsoe, and then there's draft picks involved, it would likely be the Heat's draft picks that they shipped
in
the
Dragic
deal
that
would get the job done. So maybe inadvertently, it might be, you know, a roundabout way, but the Heat could potentially have an impact if Phoenix is the one that does the deal with Cleveland.
And even if Cleveland only gets decent value, say they get Bledsoe and nothing else this year, say it's just Bledsoe and a draft pick, wouldn't they still clearly be the front runner in the East? I mean, why would you say Boston would even necessarily be close to Cleveland in that scenario, because they'd have LeBron and Love, and in this case, Bledsoe, maybe Wiggins. They'd still have some decent NBA players around them with Tristan Thompson and Kyle Korver and Derrick Rose, etc., Shumpert, J.R. Smith. So to me, this trade does not change the balance of power in the NBA this year. What it does potentially is diminish Cleveland greatly long-term if LeBron leaves.
I agree with that, and also I think that if, as long as LeBron's there, I think that they will be the favorite to win the East. But I think it might, depending on what they get in return, hurt their ability to contend in the NBA Finals themselves.
Right.
So they still would probably be able to take care of everybody, including Boston in the East. But then, I don't know. It depends. In certain scenarios, maybe it would work out. I mean, if that Paul George trade had occurred, like we believed, and if it was Kevin Love to Denver, and then some of those young players you're talking about from Denver and draft picks to the Pacers, and then the Pacers ship George to Cleveland and Kyrie Irving still there, I think a Paul George fit as compared to Kevin Love being on the team would match up better with the, you know, perimeter oriented Golden State Warriors. But again, that's not going to happen. So if it's Bledsoe, if it's Wiggins for Kyrie, I don't know. I still would wonder where the scoring punch comes from that Irving provides. Because, yeah, LeBron puts up the scoring numbers when he has to, and especially in the finals, he's proven that. But that's not really his game. And I think that's why he and Irving played well together, seemingly, because Irving, you know, is a very willing scorer.
Right, to be sure. Right. To me, one of the more interesting teams is Boston. Do they even make a legitimate offer? Do you offer that high Brooklyn pick for next year, maybe Jay Crowder along with, naturally, Isaiah Thomas? Is that something that Danny Ainge would even offer? And if you're Cleveland, would you even have interest in that package?
Yeah, it's a lot of really interesting, intriguing, fascinating questions. Before we take a break, let's go out to the phone lines. Daniel is in Miami. Daniel, thanks for coming on the program. What's going on tonight?
Oh, hey, how's it going, Greg? Just calling about the Kyrie friction in Cleveland. Just wanted to get your guys' take on, I think Kyrie's beef may not be so much with LeBron, but just more so, I think, with LeBron kind of just being the puppeteer there with Cleveland and the Tristan Thompson signing, and then obviously the Iman Shumpert and the J.R. Smith signing, where it's kind of just really paralyzed the organization. Obviously, Cleveland wasn't really able to make any moves this offseason or this summer. And I just really think that that's kind of being overlooked in some of Kyrie's frustrations with Cleveland, and then obviously them losing their GM as well. So I'll leave the line and let you guys speak on that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate the phone call. Yeah, I mean, David Griffin, I mean, from all the reports, it seems that that's been a big deal because he was an ally of Kyrie Irving's, had a very good relationship with him. And then also, I think Daniel brings up a good point, Barry, in that the way the roster is constructed certainly accentuates LeBron James' strengths. And it's not a team, though they shoot a lot of three-pointers, that gets up and down the floor at a very high pace, up-tempo style. They can score a lot, and they can shoot the ball effectively from the outside. But, you know, I would imagine Irving's skill set is probably more suited for running up and down the court, kind of like the Heat did in this past year with Goran Dragic and Deion Waiters and James Johnson to a certain degree leading the way. So I think there's something to that. But again, to the point you made, with the ego getting in the way here, you still would have thought you could suspend that for at least one more year, try to make another championship run, and, you know, overlook that for the sake of trying to win another title.
But. Right, right. And I think Irvin wants to be more of a playmaker, too. I think what frustrates him from all indications is LeBron having the ball in his hand so much. Mm-hmm. Couple things to keep in mind on Irving. Cavs 3-13 when Irving played and LeBron did not, okay? Cavs outscored by 90 points in 574 minutes during the 2016-17 regular season when Irving was on the floor and LeBron sat. During the NBA Finals, when Irving played and LeBron did not, Cavs outscored 37-13 by Golden State. So there are still real questions about whether Kyrie Irving, as immensely talented as he is offensively, can be the best player on a championship team. Right? I mean, perhaps
yes.
He could, but there's just no indication yet that he can.
No, there isn't. And he wants to be thought of that way, but many times, as we know, until you prove that you can be that guy, not many people are willing to give you that chance. That's Barry Jackson. I'm Greg Likens. We've got one more segment to go. Before we wrap things up, I do want to play the sound. We've tried to play as much sound as we can, but of course, you know, as tends to happen, we get to talking and time flies by quickly. We're going to hear from Jarvis Landry when we come back because he has been in the news because of a potential contract situation. We'll let Barry reset that news as well. Before we take a break, want to let you know that you can win a seat at the 6th annual Jeff Conine Celebrity Poker Classic at the Seminole Hard Rock Hotel August 7th. And you could win $10,000 in other prizes. Proceeds benefit Conine's Clubhouse, a home away from home for the families of children at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital. Take part in the live and silent auction. Enjoy a VIP party at Kuro Japanese Restaurant before the tournament kicks off. Win a seat by registering at theticketmiami.com. And for more information on the tournament or to make a donation, please visit ConinePokerClassic.org. Jarvis Landry Sound next here on 790. GNR back with Slash and Duff by Axel's Side, and we're giving you a chance to see them with our resident rocker, Romberg. Botron Rum and Coors present Road Tripping with Romberg. Hop on our Jungle on Wheels to see GNR at Marlins Park on August 8th to win your way on. Register at theticketmiami.com/roadtrip. Didn't win online? You'll have one last chance to win a pair at the pickup spot, Twin Peaks in Davie. Stop by at 5 p.m. on August 8th and register to win a chance to get on the bus and road trip with Romberg. Botron Rum, the taste of perfection. Award-winning Botron Rum. Rum that is not just aged, but nurtured. Sponsored by Goya Foods. If it's Goya, it has to be good. Good stuff there. Little Guns N' Roses. And man, Romberg. That guy, that'd be fun. That'd be a fun night, a fun contest to win. Hang out with Romberg, go see Guns N' Roses, be on the party bus. It's
Sounds like you're getting some trouble, but sounds like it would be a fun night. Welcome back here to 790 The Ticket. Greg Likens here alongside Barry Jackson, filling in for Josh Friedman. Final segment here on this Thursday night, what's been a very busy sports day locally with the Dolphins opening up their 2017 training camp. Just a quick update for everybody. The Marlins now lead 3-0 over the Reds in the bottom of the seventh inning as they've extended the lead. Tyler Moore flied out to right. It was a sac fly that scored Christian Yelich. So it's 3-0 right now. Marlins so far have the shutout, but a far cry from the 22-run outburst we saw last night in Texas. Barry, one of the big storylines among many is the Jarvis Landry contract situation. Before we have you provide your update on what has or maybe more appropriately hasn't happened in that regard, let's hear from Jarvis Landry. As you can imagine, he asked, I read the transcript, and you were there and witnessed this, Barry, so you can describe it once we hear the sound. But, you know, he was asked a number of different football questions, so it wasn't all about the contract. But certainly the contract came up, and this was the first thing he had to say about being out on the field amidst all these contract discussions.
Man, very. You know, I, like I said, for me, man, being a leader and having the opportunity to take another step, you know, we don't need anything hindering us off that path, you know. So for me to be here and to show the guys that, you know, it is about them and it is about the team, you know, that's what I'm here to do.
Yeah, so he decided not to hold out, I think, was the genesis of that. He went on to then get asked once again about the contract, and this is what he had to say.
Like I said, man, I'm out here just focusing on now, you know, focusing on all the things that I can control every time I step on the field. And everything else, man, it's out of my hands, it's out of my control, and I leave that with God.
All right. So, Barry, you were there. You witnessed this exchange between Jarvis and the reporters, and he's saying all the right things. He doesn't want to be a distraction. To his credit, he has reported to camp when, you know, we've seen many other instances in which players have held out if they are not happy with their contract. But as you told us earlier, and if you don't mind repeating, that on the surface, I think I've assumed, everybody else has assumed, that there have been ongoing negotiations or conversations about this, but you've heard otherwise.
Right. In fact, that is not the case. The Dolphins have not made a single offer this offseason to Jarvis Landry. And in fact, they haven't even told Landry or his representation if they intend to make a contract offer before Landry's self-imposed September 10th deadline. To me, that's shocking because everybody assumed that if Landry did things the right way, if he didn't hold out, if he showed up to the entire offseason program, that Miami would present a formidable offer for him. And that simply has not been the case. Now, could that change in the next 3 weeks? Certainly. But the Dolphins have given no indication if they're even going to make an offer. And in fact, today, Steve Ross brought up using the franchise tag as a possibility next year. Ross was asked if he's optimistic the deal will get done with Landry before the start of the season. And he said, quote, I don't know if before the season, but it's not really mandatory that we do it before the season. He also said that it's not really a question of if he's here or not. If we don't sign him now, we lose him. That's not the case. We can franchise him and go from there. There's a lot of opportunity for him to stay here. I hope he stays here. He's a great player. So that pretty much showed you what the Dolphins' thinking is, that they're not going to make an enormous offer. They might make a good offer, but I don't think they're going to make an enormous offer in the range of 5 years, $75 million, or the type of money that we see top receivers get. So how I see this playing out is, even if the Dolphins do make an offer, I'd be surprised if it's at the money Landry wants, unless Landry's willing to compromise for the long-term security. I think the Dolphins do feel like they have that franchise tag in their back pocket, and they're willing to use it. To me, here's the complicated thing, Greg, about determining what the right value is for Jarvis Landry. You can ask yourself, is he a top flight number one receiver, or is he just a great number two receiver, or is he a pretty good number one? And a couple numbers that speak to this quandary you have in determining how much to offer him. On one hand, he has the most catches. He and Odell Beckham have the most catches of any NFL players in history, first 3 years, 288. He was 10th in the league last year among receivers and tight ends in yards, 1136. He was 7th with 94 catches. But then the flip side is average per catch, 70th in the league among receivers and tight ends at 12.1. Touchdowns, 48th among receivers and tight ends with four. He's tied with a bunch of players from 48th until about 62 with only four touchdowns. Has 13 touchdown catches in 3 years. He acknowledged today that's something he's got to do a better job at. So do you. How do you reconcile the disparity in these statistical measures of receivers and come up with a legitimate offer?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's not a kind of a black and white scenario, right? I mean, it's very convoluted in terms of all these different factors that you bring to the table, and the numbers, yeah, tell different stories, right? And so I can see his side of things. Should these negotiations actually happen, you know, he and his agent could come to the table with the favorable numbers, and the Dolphins could come to the table with the not so favorable numbers. And so where do you find a compromise in terms of the financial compensation? Something that you brought up before, and I would like to echo, I do think there are intangibles that he brings to the table, which you can't quantify or measure through statistics. And maybe you can see it on the film. Maybe you just realize it. You know, maybe the coaching staff can vouch for him in that case, or his teammates. But I don't know how much that comes into play. Are we seeing a scenario potentially, Barry, where, and again, I don't claim to know more than guys I respect like a Mike Tannenbaum or Chris Greer. I mean, this is what they do for a living. So, but I think Jarvis Landry is a terrific player and has been one of their best players, if not their best player, over the last couple of years. So why they wouldn't be more urgency to get this done and to lock him up and make sure that he is part of their long-term plans, because one of the themes we saw this offseason was the loyalty and keeping guys around like Stills, like Branch. You put in the work, like Rashad Jones. You don't hold out. You know, let's, you know, knock that nonsense off. We will reward you for your hard work. That so far hasn't applied to Jarvis Landry, and I'm surprised they don't want to ensure that he's part of the long-term future.
Right. Now, I guess they could say, if they wanted to make the argument, look, we waited until February to make an offer for Kenny Stills.
Right.
We waited until February to make an offer for Andre Branch. But obviously, Landry, you're talking about a different player. You're talking about a player who's put up historical numbers in terms of volume of catches his first 3 years in the league. To me, this might be a case of them just not wanting to overpay in their mind. And if they feel they have to overpay, the preference might simply be to go year to year. Mm-hmm. Franchise him next year, and then see if a legitimate number three receiver develops behind Parker and Stills, whether it's Leonte Carew, whether they uncover someone in next year's draft, because ultimately everything comes down to value. If you can get a high-quality number three receiver at $1 million, and if Devontae Parker becomes an absolute stud, and if Kenny Stills repeats what he did last year, that's a lot of ifs, but then maybe you consider moving on from Landry, not after this year, but after next year. It would be impossible for me to envision a scenario where he's not on the team in 2018 because he have the franchise tag. And in fact, Stephen Ross, as you said, raised that unsolicited today. So, but the question is, if they feel like the number that he wants is something they're simply not comfortable with, if he does end up asking, you know, 30 to 40 million guaranteed, a 5-year deal in the 75 million range, which I could easily see him asking for. If the Dolphins are not comfortable with that number, then I think this could come down to them simply going year to year, keeping him next year, then reevaluating again after 2018.
Yeah. So, you know, take the emotions out of it, take all that other stuff, which, you know, they tend to do, especially in football. It's such a cutthroat business. But maybe it makes sense for them to be patient when it comes to this matter, as you just detailed there. But still, you know, this to me seemed like it was a simple decision for them to make in terms of keeping him around. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to play ball in terms of, you know, compromising with them, because at the same time, I would argue on the other end of things that if Jarvis Landry wants to be paid like a top five wide receiver, I don't think that's realistic either. Even though he's put up some of those numbers. So certainly, you know, we don't know the full side of his story either, but all of this will eventually be taken care of, right? I guess.
Right. And The good news is the Dolphins have one of the better top three receiving corps in the league this year.
They do.
They've got that going for them. They've got Ajayi going for them. They've got a left tackle who could be, in their eyes, a future Hall of Famer. That's what Dolphins executives have told people around the league. They think that Tunsil has Hall of Fame talent at left tackle. They have a tight end who caught 24 touchdowns in 28 games the last time he was coached by Adam Gase. Oh, by the way, Peyton Manning was his quarterback then.
Yeah.
So they have a lot going for them offensively. Questions still, obviously, are defense. We couldn't judge much today because they're still not in pads. Defensive things of note today, Xavien Howard got beaten for a touchdown by Devontae Parker. Cordrea Tankersley got beaten for a touchdown by Jakeem Grant on a long crossing play across the middle. I think they'd like, ideally, this to be a redshirt year for Tankersley. I think they'd be more than happy to have their top three corners of Maxwell, Lippitt, Howard be their boundary corners, and then their nickel corner, obviously being Alteron Verner or Bobby McCain, depending on how that battle plays out today. A couple other things from today from a defensive standpoint. Mike Hall surprisingly got first-team snaps at linebacker. When they started team drills today, it was Kiko Alonso, Lawrence Timmons, and Mike Hall as your starting linebackers. We asked Adam Gase about the battle for that third linebacker job. He mentioned how Neville Hewitt and Mike Hall have really improved and feel more comfortable. Obviously, McMillan is going to be a huge factor. It would be surprising if he's not starting either at the beginning of the season or midway through the season, but he's not going to simply be handed the job. I do know they love how McMillan has picked up the system, but they can't have any conviction yet about how McMillan will do in an NFL game because they haven't seen him in pads. Right. They can think he's going to be a good player, and a Dolphins official told me this week that they view him as a three-down linebacker eventually, but they're not going to know that for sure until they see him in pads and then they see him in preseason games.
And I know that everybody's different, but they seem to have done this with Laremy Tunsil and even Charles Harris, where at the beginning of the offseason workout program, beginning of training camp, they put them maybe a tier below where they should be on the depth chart, at least initially. And it seems to be what they like to do, at least from an initiation standpoint, maybe to rile them up a little bit. But hey, Barry, this has been fun. It's been a joy to work with you tonight. Josh will be back tomorrow night. I'll be with him. We're expecting to have Antoine Walker on at 7:15 tomorrow night. Grant, Matt, Santi, great job, guys. It's been fun working with you tonight. ESPN Radio is coming up. Barry, we'll be reading your work, and we'll hear you on 790 again soon. So have a good night as well, and we'll talk to everybody tomorrow night, 7 to 10.